From Vermont to California, Nebraska to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as the Trump administration cuts wasteful spending, should government-funded media like NPR and PBS be on the chopping block? Brian Rankin from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with the answer. With the continuing resolution passed to fund the federal government for the remainder of this fiscal year, attention now turns to enacting the Trump economic agenda. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. It is known as the Jones Act, and it is driving up the cost of shipping between domestic ports. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details of a legal challenge to the act from Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And President Trump is proposing the creation of a National Garden of American Heroes to celebrate those who have made significant contributions to our nation. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Taxpayers have been subsidizing left-leaning National Public Radio, or NPR, and PBS television stations for decades. But as the Trump administration works to trim the federal budget, has the time come for ending such funding? Brian Rankin is an adjunct fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is here to discuss. Brian, welcome to American Radio Journal. Brian, when we talk about NPR, National Public Radio, and PBS, the Public Broadcasting Service or system, tell us a little bit about how these entities got started. What was the lay of the land whenever they came into being and the rationale for that?
Public media was created for a media landscape that doesn't exist anymore. Public media as we know it today began when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is an independent nonprofit, was created by the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. So it is a creation of the Great Society. And at that time, it was common for a community to have access to, say, only three or maybe four television stations. There would have been mostly AM radio stations, as FM was just beginning to gain popularity. So obviously, the media landscape is dramatically different today. Whether you could look at cable channels, which are still in full force, podcasts, streaming, all the other platforms. Yet this year, the CPB is receiving a federal appropriation of $535 million. Last year, it received $525 million, so it got a $10 million increase this year. And that funding, the way the money works, is the funding is distributed by the CPB to the local public radio and television stations who carry NPR and PBS programming. So the funding doesn't go directly to NPR and PBS, but it goes to the local radio and television station. And that funding represents roughly 10% of local public television station revenue. Now, that may vary by markets, as for rural stations, the federal funding may be a larger portion of their overall funding, but generally it's only about 10% of what local stations receive. And of course, as is often the case, when you deal with money from the federal government, there are strings attached. So public radio and television affiliates are prohibited by statute from running commercial advertising. So they get no commercial advertising revenues, at least, you know, cannot lawfully get them. And so as I look at this, I think given our $36 trillion and growing national debt, the ongoing work to reduce the size of the federal government that's leading to spending cuts throughout the government, and then the extensive choices that we have for news, information, and educational programming today, I think we just need to ask why.
Of course, the defenders of public broadcasting here, Brian, will say, well, they've given us things like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood or Sesame Street. And that is true. Those were some very valuable programming that was put out by public broadcasting. But you can now get that elsewhere, correct?
That is correct. There's all kinds of diverse sources for educational programming. And I certainly agree. I think that there's been some very good programming. You think about PBS, you had a couple of good examples. I personally enjoy shows like American Experience and American Masters and many of the other documentaries. But that doesn't mean the federal government should be funding it. I mean, I think these are two really separate questions, because media outlets like yours and every other commercial radio, television, and all these other platforms that are on streaming that we enjoy on our phones, on computers, and increasingly on our television sets, they're not receiving government funding, yet they're able to make it as going concern. So I think we've come to the time when we really need to call this question and think about winding this funding down for NPR and PBS affiliates.
There also has been some concern raised. There was a big controversy here a year or so back about the content, that it tends to skew very heavily to, shall we say, the left side of the political spectrum. So from that point of view, have these outlets, NPR in particular, been sometimes a conduit, you know, really more for propaganda than for news?
Well, I will cite for you an essay that was written last year by an editor at NPR, a man named Uri Berliner, who wrote an essay where he just plainly stated that NPR had a liberal bias and that, in fact, tainted its coverage of important news stories. And he cited COVID-19 and the Hunter Biden laptop and other examples where he thought that their coverage was tainted because of the bias that was within there. So we have an internal source who's saying that. It's not just the perception of people outside of NPR who listen to the programming. Also in that essay, he cites a survey where it shows that 57% of NPR's listeners identify as liberal or very liberal. So I would posit this question, because I don't think government should be funding media at all. And I would posit this question to those listeners. Let's say that NPR had a change of management, and instead of the content they have today, they changed to a more right-of-center content, where they sounded more like Fox News. Would those listeners want their tax dollars going to fund that? My guess is they probably would not. And therein lies the rub. That is why the government shouldn't be funding this at all. If there was ever a case for it, we've long since passed the time when that case was there for funding NPR and PBS affiliates.
We have been talking with Brian Rankin, who is an adjunct fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Brian, tell us a little bit about CEI. Also, you write on this and related topics. Where can folks go to find those writings?
The Competitive Enterprise Institute is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank that's dedicated to eliminating excessive regulation and unleashing human potential through free markets. And you can find my writing and the work of all of our experts at CEI.org.
Brian Rankin of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Brian, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson, at the Club for Growth, there has been a new continuing resolution that has been passed, but that all-important reconciliation bill still lies ahead. We're going to discuss all of it with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let's recap here. The continuing resolution, it passed here a week or so ago. So we have that as far as the current budget year is concerned. But there's also been some fallout, especially for Chuck Schumer over in the U.S. Senate. Want to give us a brief recap of the CR?
Yeah, you know, the CR passed through the House of Representatives. Conservatives really wanted to alleviate the probability of a big bipartisan spending deal in the spring. And so normally conservatives in the House would oppose the CR, but they found a way to cut non-defense discretionary spending by a little bit and still maintain some necessary increases on defense spending and overall cut spending by $6 billion and then kick that over to the Senate. They left town and really jammed Chuck Schumer, who at first said there was no way he was going to provide the votes. Well, Chuck Schumer has a new nickname as a caveman, And he did cave and has really been called out by his Democrat colleagues. He ultimately helped provide about 10 votes in the United States Senate to obtain cloture, and then only a couple of them voted for final passage. So it's the old cliche of voting for the bill before they voted against it. Well, people like AOC have really been taking on Chuck Schumer hard through her political organization with the Justice Democrats. And, you know, Schumer is not up for re-election until 2028, but I think that there is a growing appetite from the far left, the radical left, these big progressives that want to take out Chuck Schumer because they don't think that he's the man for the moment in fighting back against Donald Trump.
As all of that continues to play out, we have this reconciliation process. This is the process by which a lot of the Trump economic agenda, including extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and eliminating taxes on things like wages, tips, Social Security, overtime, all of that is into play there. Where do we stand in that process?
Well, the quick recap is reconciliation is a process that allows Congress to bypass the filibuster in the Senate and pass things with a simple majority, as long as it pertains to revenues, federal spending, or the debt limit. And so what we have right now is the House has passed their budget resolution. The Senate passed a much smaller budget resolution that only deals with energy and border security policies, does not tackle the tax cuts. So what we have right now is sort of this ongoing negotiation. People in the D.C. Beltway call it a pre-conference, where the leadership between the John Thune and Speaker Johnson are trying to determine what the contours of one big, beautiful bill would look like. And I think that a disastrous fallback plan would be to only adjudicate a smaller bill that includes energy reforms and border security money. So this negotiation has been ongoing. So it's a big, big time here. One of the developments that's happened recently in the House of Representatives is that Congressman Andrew Gabarino from New York has spearheaded a letter to actually preserve a big part of Joe Biden's legacy from the Inflation Reduction Act. And that legislation allowed for these clean energy tax credits, these green tax credits to take place. And unfortunately, there's some, Republicans that are within the middle of the aisle, I think it's fair to characterize them, and they want to maintain that special interest tax break for green energy companies through this clean energy tax credit. And, you know, Club for Growth certainly opposes that, right? That would make it much harder to expand the Trump tax cuts. The credits initially were scored by the Congressional Budget Office to only cost roughly $200 billion. And I know that sounds like an enormous number, but they were taken up at such a high rate that when CBO went back and scored the Inflation Reduction Act, that provision actually exacerbated our debt and deficit issues by over 300%. For that cost, and it was over $663 billion in reality. So we want to push back against those Republicans. You know, I think the bottom line is Donald Trump has said that he opposes the Inflation Reduction Act, and he has called for its full repeal. And then you have these 21 House Republicans that want to put their arms around Doge and Elon Musk and say how great all this stuff is. But then, you know, the big expensive provisions of Biden's, you know, sort of bellwether policy, bellwether law that he got through, they want to preserve that. That's outrageous. We want to make sure that provision goes away.
And of course, there is a political equation to all of this, which is we need all of this to happen in a way that Trump's economic policies actually impact the economy before we hit the midterms, correct?
That's a great point. You know, right now, I think that there's an optimism that we can finish the tax cuts by the August recess at the end of July. And you might remember in 2017, we did the Trump tax cuts in December. That's when they got signed into law because Republicans first fiddled around with trying to repeal Obamacare and were unsuccessful in that ultimately. So the issue was that there wasn't a big economic boom up until, you know, after the 2018 midterms. And the result was we lost the House majority, and that led to the impeachment inquiries by Nancy Pelosi and AOC and sort of the new squad that took power in the 2018 midterms. We got to avoid that, and we got to make sure that we've got momentum. So that means getting these tax cuts done as quickly as possible so that they'll have a big impact in the macroeconomic sense of increasing wages, productivity, the number of jobs, and overall a big boost to GDP.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is an economic organization based out of Washington, D.C. If you want to learn about us and why we support freedom, opportunity, and liberty in economic policy, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson joins us every week here on American Radio Journal. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
An antiquated law is driving up the cost of shipping goods between American ports. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation.
So I consider myself to be someone who knows a fair bit about the U.S. Constitution. And if you're listening to this show, then I imagine that you are probably at least somewhat familiar with it, too. So let me tell you, there's few things more exciting. And I know this makes me a nerd, but there's few things more exciting than learning about a new little wrinkle, a new little detail that the founders put in there that I'd never heard of before, never come across before. And it's even better when that little detail, that little wrinkle is something that might be able to take down what I think is a seriously flawed and broken law. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about this interesting little constitutional wrinkle that they are going to use to challenge the constitutionality of the Jones Act. We'll get into all that in just a second. Let's bring him on the show here first. Josh, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on.
I really want to get into the cool constitutional stuff here, but we got to start with the basics. You guys have filed a lawsuit this week challenging the constitutionality of the Jones Act. I imagine at least some of our listeners have never heard of that law before. So what is the Jones Act?
The Jones Act was passed just after World War I, and it was designed to strengthen the U.S. military capabilities, national security, and maritime capabilities. It purported to do this by requiring that all shipping between American ports be done by ships that are owned and crewed and flagged as American. That maybe doesn't sound too bad, but over a century later, the law has proven to be a catastrophe. Despite its lofty goals, the Jones Act has significantly increased the cost of domestic shipping, stifled competition, created inefficiencies, and even weakened the maritime industry itself, despite reporting to protect it. We have fewer ships than we had before. We have fewer mariners than we had before. And shipping is more expensive than it was before. And that's all due to the Jones Act.
Yeah, the Jones Act honestly just drives me crazy because the lack of competition in shipping means, you know, just to kind of put a fine point on this, it's a lot cheaper to ship something from Los Angeles to Australia than it is from Los Angeles to Hawaii, even though that's a lot closer because there's not as many ships that can do it. So obviously the ships that are allowed to do it can charge a lot more. And this is important. I mentioned Hawaii because your client in this case is somebody on the Hawaiian Islands who thinks they're being treated unfairly by the law.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So our client is a rum producer and seller. They like to ship their rums to the mainland so people on the mainland can enjoy their unique flavors. But unfortunately, it's very expensive to ship from Hawaii to Los Angeles. It's actually a lot more expensive to ship from Hawaii to Los Angeles than to ship from Hawaii to Asia or Australia or any of these other many other far-flung places, despite them being much longer routes. And again, that's because of the Jones Act. There's only two shippers available to Hawaiian businesses, and they can't use foreign flag vessels to get their products to the mainland.
Yeah, it's the same story as always with protectionism. If you limit competition, you drive up prices, that's what happens. The Jones Act is an economic failure. Maybe it's a constitutional failure too. We're talking with Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about their new lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Jones Act. And Josh, this is the part that's really exciting for constitution nerds like me, because you guys have dug into Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution and pulled out something called the Port Preference Clause, which I've never heard of before, but it's been there for nearly 250 years. What does that mean, and how is that relevant to all this?
Sure. So I can't really blame you for not being familiar with it. It's a little used clause in the Constitution. And on top of that, it's fairly obscure. I hadn't even heard of it myself until we started looking into this issue. And so basically it says that the United States can't pass a law that discriminates against a state's ports in favor of another state's ports. And so in this case, we're talking about Hawaii. Hawaii does not have access to alternative shipping options like mainland states do. They can't ship their goods to Los Angeles on the back of a long-haul truck. They can't use rails. They can't use any sort of alternative shipping. And so they're stuck with Jones Act compliant shipping options, which puts them at a huge disadvantage whenever it comes to competing with mainland businesses or even foreign businesses. At the time that the Jones Act was passed, Hawaii wasn't even a state. And so one of the explicit purposes from the sponsors of the bill was to discriminate against Hawaiian and Alaskan shipping in favor of mainland shipping. So in other words, Hawaii and Alaska would subsidize the shipping for mainland states. And so because the Jones Act imposes this discriminatory effect, we think that the Port Preference Clause can be used to attack it.
Okay, so I mean, I can imagine historically the reason that clause is in there is because, you know, in the 1780s, there would have been all sorts of concerns about, like, well, the federal government could pass a law that preferences the port of Boston over the port of New York or over the port of Charleston, something like that. The framers wanted to keep the federal government from being able to put its thumb on the scale of those kind of local economies. But now here, this is what's really cool is that that's there. You guys can pull it out and use it to at least make the courts consider this question of you know, whether this law unfairly preferences certain ports over others. It seems to me like it does. There's a really interesting angle here. Give me a sense going forward now of what happens next. This is obviously just at the very beginning of things here, but where are you hoping to get with this?
We are hoping that we can take down the cabotage provisions. So those are the provisions that require basically the main problem with the Jones Act, which is requiring that all ships shipping goods between ports in America be flagged, owned, and crewed by Americans. We're hoping to get those struck down, at least as applied to the non-contiguous states like Alaska and Hawaii. And so we filed the case in federal court in D.C. This is we're in the very early stages here, but that's what we're ultimately hoping to achieve.
And PLF, of course, has a pretty terrific track record of getting cases in front of the Supreme Court. So fingers crossed that we'll see this one. Maybe it doesn't even have to go that far. Who knows? But we'll certainly see the courts have to weigh in on this, you know, for the first time. And that is always exciting and interesting. Josh, we are out of time for today, but thanks for walking us through all this.
Okay. Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you.
And once again, that is Joshua Polk. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Check out their work online on this case and lots of other fascinating stuff at pacificlegal.org. Find our coverage of this lawsuit as well at reason.com. You can check out the piece I wrote this week. Is the Jones Act unconstitutional? That is the question that the courts will be asked thanks to this lawsuit. Check that out there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
To honor those who have played a significant role in the building of our nation, President Trump has proposed creation of a Garden of American Heroes. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Quote, "Today we pay tribute to the generations of Black legends, champions, warriors, and patriots who helped drive our country forward to greatness." So said President Donald Trump in an East Room ceremony during Black History Month. With the legendary golfer Tiger Woods at his side, Trump said in a live televised ceremony, quote, "We pay tribute to these heroes, not just because they are Black heroes, but also because they are truly American heroes who inspire all of us," unquote. Donald Trump thrilled the audience that afternoon, which applauded as he rattled off names of various Black figures to be honored in a special National Garden of American Heroes. Trump named Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, Billie Holiday, Coretta Scott King, Kobe Bryant, and MLK Jr. In fact, those are just a few of the names of notable African Americans on a long list of Americans that Donald Trump wants to be represented with statues in the National Garden of Heroes. This is not a new concept by Donald Trump. He's actually resurrecting a 2020 proposal to create a Garden of Heroes that he first announced at an Independence Day celebration at Mount Rushmore in July of 2020. Donald Trump thereafter proceeded to issue several executive orders for the Garden of Heroes, including a final one on January 18, 2021, right before he exited office for Joe Biden. Trump's idea was a great idea, I thought, but it was killed right away by the woke brigades in May 2021 when Joe Biden became president. They not only wanted not to recognize many of the figures in Trump's proposal, but to tear down memorials to them. The left was thrilled with Biden spiking Trump's executive orders. A disgustingly biased Politico news article on Biden rescinding Trump's order put the words "American heroes" in quotes and listed as examples only baseball player Cy Young, Jeopardy host Alex Trebek, and Kobe Bryant. The article named none of the extensive list of African Americans that I've noted here today in this commentary. Liberals, it turns out, can't report details like that because such truths undermine their propaganda and disinformation efforts. But the good news is this. Now the idea is back, and this time Donald Trump is pushing it at the start of his administration rather than at the end. And as I said, his list is impressive. It's also eclectic, and it's very long. In fact, if you look online to the original executive order or Wikipedia, you can read for yourself. That said, let me give some examples. Liberals will be astonished to see that on Donald Trump's list for his Garden of Heroes are the names of a bunch of prominent left-wingers and Democrats, such as Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Andrew Jackson, Grover Cleveland, Harry Truman, John Kennedy. By the way, I think there are more Democrat than Republican presidents on Trump's list. Trump also includes Ruth Bader Ginsburg, left-wing entertainers like Woody Guthrie and Lauren Bacall, and even religious left figures such as Dorothy Day. Now, those aside, indulge me as I share a few of my own favorites from Trump's list. Bishop Fulton Sheen, Andrew Carnegie, Betsy Ross, Frank Capra, Susan B. Anthony, Dwight Eisenhower, Todd Beamer, Krista McAuliffe, remember her, the astronaut? Irving Berlin, Johnny Cash, Whitaker Chambers, Roberto Clemente, Claire Booth Luce, Bob Hope, Lou Gehrig, Henry Ford, Dr. Seuss, Jonas Salk, Shirley Temple, Edgar Allan Poe, Billy Graham, Thomas Merton, Frank Sinatra, Elvis, Jimmy Stewart, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Alvin York, Frank Lloyd Wright, and above all, Christopher Columbus. Wait, Columbus? Well, no wonder the leftists hate Trump's list. Among the many Black Americans on the list, I'm pleased to also note Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, Whitney Houston, Ray Charles, Medgar Evers, Jesse Owens, Augustus Tolton, the ex-slave who became one of America's first Black priests. And also I'm pleased to note that Amelia Earhart is on the list. I did an American Radio Journal commentary last summer about the fascinating research done by billionaire philanthropist Tim Mellon to locate Earhart's buried plane. Earhart was an incredible individual who certainly merits recognition in the Garden of Heroes. So take a look at that list online and think of anyone that you think might be included. By the way, I nominate Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, not on that list. All hail the Garden of Heroes. Kudos to Donald Trump for a great list. Let's hope people take it seriously. Let the construction begin. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WFAY AM and FM in Fayetteville, North Carolina, along with KZUL FM in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.